I want to start by just expressing my great gratitude to be able to talk about this life-saving, world-transforming Dharma. Such boundless gratitude to all of you. And I've given Dharma talks for many years at all the different Boundless Way Sanghas, and also the evening encouragement talks on Sesshin. But this is my first Taisho. And just to give you guys a little window into a piece of my process, let me just say, I am freaked the fuck out. There's a koan that I think relates to that. Jiaozhou's non-vindication. A monk asked Jiaozhou, "You say that supreme way is not difficult. It simply dislikes choosing. Isn't that a pit into which people today have fallen?" Jiaozhou said, "Once someone asked me about that. Since then, for 5 years, I haven't been able to apologize for it." After this morning round of Doksan, David and I were the first two finished, and so I stopped him in the hall and said to him, "Can I be excused from the Taisho today?" And David was very, very helpful. He said, "Yes, but you still have to give it." So, in that spirit, I apologize. Let's dive in and look at our text. Taking part in the gathering. The mind of the great Indian immortal moves seamlessly between East and West. It's human nature to be quick or slow, but in the way, there are no northern or southern ancestors. The mysterious source of the bright is clear and unstained. Branches of light stream from that dark. Trying to control things is only delusion. But hanging on to the absolute isn't enlightenment either. We and everything we perceive are interwoven and not interwoven. And this interweaving continues on and on, while each thing stands in its own place. In the world of form, we differentiate substances and images. In the world of sound, we distinguish music from noise. In the embrace of the dark, good words and bad words are the same. But in the bright, we divide clear speech from confusion. The four elements return to their natures like a child to its mother. Fire is hot. The winds blow. Water is wet. The earth solid. The eye sees form. The ear hears voices. The nose smells fragrance. The tongue tastes salt and sour. Everything, depending on its roots, spreads out its leaves. Both roots and branches must return to their origin, and so do respectful and insulting words. The darkness is inside the bright, but don't look only with the eyes of the dark. The brightness is inside the dark, but don't look only through the eyes of the bright. Bright and dark are a pair, like front foot and back foot walking. Each thing by nature has worth, but we notice it is shaped by its circumstances. Things fit together like boxes and lids, while the absolute is like arrows meeting in midair. When you let these words in, you encounter the ancestors. Don't limit yourself to your own small story. If you don't see the way with your own eyes, you won't know the road, even as you're walking on it. Walking the way, we're never near or far from it. Deluded, we are cut off from it by mountains and rivers. You who seek the mystery in daylight or in the shadows of night, don't throw away your time. So, this piece, the other title of this piece is the harmonizing of relative and absolute. I remember once in my other Zen life, one of my first teachers was talking about what, in his view, was the functioning of a Zen teacher. He said, the student points to the relative, the teacher points to the absolute. The student points to the absolute, the teacher points to the relative. The student points to both, the teacher points to neither. The student points to neither, the teacher points to both. That's Zen teaching. And I remember thinking to myself, how is that not just being an asshole? And I think there might have been an element of orneriness at play there, but there's also something very important that we've been hearing, and as any of you who come to see any of us in Doksan experience, and this flowing back and forth, being able to pour ourselves back and forth between these two things that aren't two things, the relative and the absolute, form and emptiness. That's the capacity we're developing in our Zazen practice, whether it's Shikantaza or koans, that's the capacity that we're getting the opportunity to embody and express in our Doksan encounters, regardless of their content. And that functioning is the thing that enables us to touch this underlying, fundamental, completely and utterly reliable okayness that is always present, even in black, black, black depression, even amid pounding hearts of anxiety, even in physical pain, in grief. This underlying, completely reliable refuge is always there for us, always supporting us, and our knowing it or seeing it actually has no impact on the matter. Although, as we, in some moments, perhaps on Seishin, start to see it for ourselves, start to know it for ourselves, verify that the stuff that these ancestors and our own teachers up here jabbering away day after day on Seishin, Teisho after Teisho, that what they're saying actually is not them trying to baffle us or sell us a bill of goods, but it is actually what we can see and find and verify. And we get glimpses into that. And those glimpses pass. And we can't see what once we did. We might see it again. But those glimpses gradually strengthen a capacity for faith, a capacity for trusting that underlying ground of being is there, even when you have a story that you're not seeing it right now. Important to also know that is a story. But however true that seems, however certain you are that this can't be it, I must be wrong. Even when those arise, there's an okayness there that we can depend on, even then, that we can trust is there. Even if the form that formless okayness takes, even if that form is fear, terror, self-hatred. So, we and everything we perceive are interwoven and not interwoven. And this interweaving continues on and on while each thing stands in its own place. It's not that there aren't two things. And it's not that the two things are one. And it's this constant interweaving, this intermingling, this expanding and contracting, enlightening and in darkening. This practice of Zazen enables us to be more and more spaciously able to hold this and not this, absolute and relative, without needing to collapse them, without breaking them completely apart, and without making one of them superior, better than the other. That's also the very thing we're practicing in our Zazen when we unhook from a thought, discern a story, a reaction, an objection as a thing that's arisen. But none of those things, none of our ideas, not the absolute, not the relative, none of these, not both, not neither, and both and neither, none of these capture it, because it's actually this dynamic interweaving, intermingling. Master Sheng Yen, in a different translation of those same four lines, says, every Dharma door, or every Dharma gate, as we chant it, includes all realms. Some mutually interact, others do not. Reaction increases mutual involvement. There should be no reliance on abiding in one place. You can try to rely on this abiding in one place. You can try to rely on this abiding only in calmness and serenity and peace and the special states of mind that are a byproduct, but that sometimes come up on the third, fourth, fifth day of Sesshin. You can try to abide there in that one place, but it'll pass. And the fact that it passes tells us something important. That's not the thing that liberates us. Every Dharma door includes all realms. We can hear this all realms in many different ways. We can hear it One way is as the heaven realms of meditative bliss and the hell realms of burning self-criticism. In the human realms, where there's some of both and space from each. Or the animal realms, where there's no space between reaction and response. Every door includes all realms. We can enter this okayness through any door, through any mind state, any self. And for me, this is very fortunate because I spend a lot of my time in hell realms. And so, if this were not a practice that you could enter from a hell realm, I would have ceased to be long ago. Hell realms aren't a barrier. Even when mountains and rivers block your way, mountains and rivers still don't block your way. They are your way. We've been hearing a lot about the light and the dark. In John Terence's translation, he says, "The darkness is inside the bright, but don't look only with the eyes of the dark. The brightness is inside the dark, but don't look only through the eyes of the bright." One thing we hear acknowledged here is that there are insights. They're real. And it's not about that. And they're useful, these insights. And that is being able to have a capacity to look with the eyes of the light at dark. Sometimes there's that's part of what's possible. But those things are conditional. That, looking with the eyes of your insight, your past insight, at your current suffering, is not necessarily dependable. The thing that you can depend on is being able to receive the dark as dark. Receive the light as light. Hongzhi, in The Guideposts for Silent Illumination, talks a little bit about this. He says, "In darkness, it is most bright, while hidden, all the more manifest." So what is it that is bright and vivid in the darkness? In the pitch black room, what do you have a clear, completely unobstructed vision of? While it's hidden, while you can't find it, while you can't touch that thing that was so helpful yesterday, it's gone now. What's all the more manifest then? When the mind of Sesshin passes and you're at home, back in your more complex lives, Don't try to look with the eyes of Sesshin at the rest. And please continue to come to Sesshin. Also related to this is some really beautiful, good advice from the poet Wendell Berry. To know the dark, this poem is called. To go in the dark with the light is to know the light. To know the dark, go without sight. And find the dark too blooms and sings and is traveled by dark feet and dark wings. Sort of gild the lily here a little more. To go in the dark with a light is to know the light. You can't use a flashlight to find the darkness. That'll never be what you're shining the flashlight on. Just close with a few more words about walking the way. We're never near or far from it. Deluded, we're cut off from it by mountains and rivers, and still, we're never near or far from it. Master Dogen speaks to this beautifully in the Genjo Koan. The word Genjo Koan can be translated as actualizing the fundamental point. Dogen says, here is the place. Here the path unfolds. The boundary of realization is not distinct, for the realization comes forth simultaneously with the mastery of the Buddha Dharma. Do not suppose that what you realize becomes your knowledge and is grasped by your consciousness. We should not think that what we have attained is conceived by ourselves and known by our discriminating mind. Although complete enlightenment is immediately actualized, its intimacy is such that it does not necessarily form as a view. In fact, viewing is not something fixed, which is to say, don't limit yourself to your own small story of what it is. Don't limit yourself also to a large story, to a grandiose story, to a story of enlightenment itself, to an experience of Anyatara Samyak Sambodhi, supreme, unsurpassed, perfect enlightenment. Don't be caught even by that story. Because viewing is not something fixed. So, as is our tradition, we welcome comments and responses.
See the way you do not see it, even as you walk on it. Zen archery, and he's failing miserably at it. He can't hit the target. And he encounters somebody who's learned Western archery, and the Westerner teaches him a whole bunch of techniques, and he starts using this and practices it and does much better. And he comes up to his Zen teacher, sees him, or his Zen archery teacher, and is first very intrigued, you know, the sudden improvement in the student, and then becomes very angry with him because he sees that he's using these techniques in order to hit the target. My question, Josh, you started your Taisho with a koan about the teaching of Zen is all about avoiding picking and choosing. How did you choose that koan for your first Taisho?
Well, all I can say is I did choose it, and I can't apologize enough for that.
I want to thank you for sharing your process. It's very heartening.
Yeah, well, you know, I have been distressed at every level to realize again and again and again that it's still just me. As much as I want liberation, as much as I want, you know, changing robes to mint a new and better me, this is what I got. And that has become, I wouldn't trade it for anything. I wouldn't trade being freaked the fuck out.
It's an honor to be here for your first Taisho, and of course we only met yesterday for the first time. So your process leading up to this day is unknown to me, only from the perspective of the faith that you refer to that I have in the process that is this practice. And so I accept your role in this Sangha and on the basis of the faith that I have in this process. And you refer to that in your Taisho. You use the word faith. It's been an important part of my own process and practice to, in the initial stages of it, to get past the idea that somehow there was going to be an experience that was going to transform me permanently, and that there was this light bulb of enlightenment that went off, whether it was Kensho or whether it was something that happened later on, or whether it had something to do with wearing a Roksu or any other symbol that represented some kind of attainment. And then getting past that, the question arises, okay, what? The entering into the cultural context of Zen, even as I've done coming to this session, moving from one particular Sangha's practice to another, seeing what's the same, what's different, understanding, helps me understand a little bit of the way that part of this practice involves having faith, having a trust and confidence that whatever is happening is in fact okay, and that it's all part of what's going on over time. I know at the end of this session I'm still going to be me. I know at the end of another 16 or 20 or 30 or however long I live years of practice, I'm still going to be me. So the point of my conversation here and the question I guess I have for you is if experiences of insight are transient like everything else, are impermanent, and and if faith is in some ways also a cultural artifact, is a religious phenomenon, what changes in the practice of Zen over a lifetime?
So, a lot there.
Yes.
I'm going to just pull out two parts. And so, regarding faith, there are three kinds of faith. There's provisional faith, where, based on the best information we have, based on what we can tell, we think that this practice is going to help, is a good thing to do. We think that our teachers are not misleading us, and we have not personally verified what they have, but we're putting provisional faith in this practice, and that's important. And that's not the faith that I was talking about. There's another faith that is really not the type that I was talking about, which is the cultural artifact faith, which is the faith of I believe. But the third kind of faith is unshakable faith, is faith that's like your faith in gravity. Whether or not you believe in gravity doesn't actually matter. When you step one after another, it's there. And even if you become an anti-gravityist and really deny, still there. And when you see what in our experience in reality is the analog to that gravity, then it becomes a whole other kind of faith. But returning to what I think is the heart of what you are saying, I know that I'm going to be the same. I know that in 16 years. Don't get trapped even in that small story. And even right now, you're not the same. Even right now, that's not true. There's that story arising. And recognizing stories as stories is what's liberating about this practice.
Is there a microphone? I want to say how touched I was by your whole talk, just to start with. Thank you. Having lived through some of the process, which we all live through, so it's beautiful to speak to it. I'm really struck by your quite complex question, but I want to pull out a different thread from it, if that's all right. That I also feel very strongly, and I felt it when you were giving the talk. I really believe that we stay the same person through a lifetime, that the problems that we encountered as children tend to persist into ancient adulthood. I've seen old people die, and they're not really, I mean, there's something that persists, these patterns. And I also see that they get looser. They become stories, small stories. That I have a story that Josh and I are brother and sister in the inadequacy family. And, you know, we got really good training in it from early childhood, I would say. And the danger for me, I'll just speak about myself, in buying that story as if it was the only description of me, is that it's limiting. And I think that's what Josh is referring to, and that's what John Tarrant says in that beautiful translation, to use small story. Because I sometimes get choked in that story. It just limits me, and it's not fair to other people either. There's a lot more to each one of us than that small story. So I think that for me, Zen practice really does open me beyond the story. without me having to say, I'm not that person anymore, that's done, check, I had this experience, light came in the window, oh, fantastic, I'm done, now what am I going to do? Oh. Mm-hmm. Instead, you know, this is the Zen life. I love this text too because it points to it, that flexibility. We get narrow and then we open. And every time we open, we can't buy the narrowness as the only truth anymore. There's no such thing, really, as my truth, my story. There's this being human. So I'm glad you gave me an opportunity to say it, both of you.
Lily's down there too. Am the same person, am not the same person. Both am and am not. Neither am nor am not.
Don't get in. You said that.
Who did say that? There will be repercussions.
I get thrown by, you know, metaphors, light and dark. You know, sometimes I think I know what the dark, what they're referring to is. Sometimes, something comes along and dislodges me again. You know, so, you know, in some cases, darkness is, you know, I think I'm talking about depression or, you know, self-doubt or self-pitying, but also maybe bad things in the world, you know, war, poverty, etc. And then other times, you know, when you read story of, or read the poem of Wendell Berry, dark is more of a positive quality. And even in the same Ukai, I mean, we've read it four times already. Each time I think, well, I think the dark is this. But it's actually, you know, it's a good thing. No, it's a bad thing. And don't give me this, you know, yes, it's good, no, it's not, and yes, it's bad, and it's both not good and not bad.
Okay.
What are we referring to here?
Yeah, that's a great
So
question.
I would say yes, it's good, and no, it's bad.
What was that you said a minute ago?
I think actually, Willie, you're actually demonstrating the heart of this matter, of the relative and the interpenetration of the relative and absolute. One of the things I think we haven't emphasized much from this text that I think is also important, that in some way he's holding the dark up as the absolute. He's holding the dark as an image where we can't distinguish good and bad phrases. So in this world where we're not in the world of the particular, not in the manifestation of sunlight coming in the room, but entering this world that we point to a lot, but this experience that we sometimes call emptiness, we could just as well call it fullness or pure possibility. We call it the Dharmakaya, this great fertile realm of a deep and beautiful silence from which everything springs. And I think Wendell Berry is heading in that same direction. Moving beyond, you know, usually, Willie, as you say, light is good and dark is bad. So I think exactly where what you notice inside is intentional here. And that part of, in a sense, part of what we're doing in this Zen project is enlivening every place, finding wherever we go, and in this undifferentiated realm, which is a realm that we do explore here in Zen. So as we're sitting in our Zazen, there is some place, something that is possible for humans to enter into. We can't really talk about it, but it's ungraspable, unnameable. We sing about it. And actually so important as we practice to enter, to be, as we are intimate with the particular, we can find that in the particular is this absolute, exactly what he's saying. And these places that we can hold back from. Oh, it's dark, I don't know, it's undifferentiated. Actually some real imperative here to die to the little story and enter something beyond, but also not beyond.
Mike?
Hard to pick up there with the dying to the little story. Melissa, your story resonates for me, the sense of being choked. Sense of inadequacy that often comes from me. I feel it right now. And the paradox for me is how fully showing up that way is how the particular is the absolute. And it seems to me that I have to learn this again and again and again. And I keep wanting to shy away from this place of terror, this place of closing up, this place of grief. And then one of you gives me a good hard push. And there's no other choice. And then we can show up in that place and be that fully. It's why I love the final Bodhisattva vow. You know, I vow to embody it. As the opposite of what I think, I often think that the practice is going to be that I'm going to get rid of that shit.
Yeah.
I think that again and again. And then somehow I slip into being it completely. And that's the absolute, that's the freedom.
Thank you for that.
Thank you.
Melissa, I wanted to pick up on your thought that, in fact, some of these patterns continue, even though we're not the same person. There are patterns that continue from childhood right to, you know, and I go to that inadequate place too. But one of the things that I've noticed is that as we get older and we encounter old age and sickness and we face death and all these things, these slings and arrows, that actually these small stories look like life rafts. That even feeling inadequate looks like a life raft, because I know that. I know what that's like. If I can just grab onto it and I can just go there. And that what's really scary is to get a taste of that thing that's bigger.
Yes.
That's really walking off of a cliff.
Yeah.
And that this practice allows us to hold those stories less tightly, gives us the glimpse of what's scary and unknown, and may help us not cling even tighter, not become even more entrenched in those old habits as we get older and things challenge us more and more.
Yeah, thank you. But I think that's what I was pointing to when I said it's not fair to other people if we act from that place. But what you're pointing to is this deep fear of not being that person. I mean, it's clear to me that Josh and you and Mike, anyway, are not inadequate. I'm sorry. I apologize for saying.
Could you apologize for that?
I'm going to go on and on and on. I mean, it's just, and if I know I've gotten feedback sometimes when I act from that place as if it's the only place, it's actually hurtful.
Yeah.
It's sort of like a big joke. That what? Oh, come on, you're just saying that because you're really wonderful and you can say that you're inadequate. You know, it's like, you know that joke that I think James tells me all the time.
Right.
And the, you know, I'm Chin Shui, solitary and destitute. You've just drunk three cups of the finest wine in China. Don't give me that. What are you saying? So it's both. What Mike said was so... See, this is... We're actually pointing to the same teaching from different places. This is the harmony of the relative and absolute. The five ranks, you know, there's relative, there's absolute, there's relative coming through the absolute, there's absolute coming through the relative, there's neither, there's both, all that stuff. The mind can go, whing, and then we can go into our inadequacy. But I love what you said about the little life raft, too, and I just want to underline it, because that's what we do. We cling to the old story, and we don't know that, right? And, you know, if we just step into the ocean, we'll be held up by it. There's something that we don't know. So I think being with that terror is a big part of this practice.
And for me also, thing, I love the image of the life raft and the seduction of going back to our old stories and how dangerous that can be. And, you know, the other part here is this is the mountains and rivers that are the path that we walk on and become the gate of our liberation. And for me, the trick is when I'm not grasping it so tight or allowing it to grasp me by the throat, then that possibility of it becoming a door or a gate rather than an anchor opens up. And it's just, yeah. Isn't it weird?
And cool.
And the point that arises in me is the surprising point that as human beings, we resist exactly what we're going after.
Yeah.
You know, when we start to get a taste of it, it's unfamiliar. It's weird. It's like, well, what am I supposed to do if I'm not doing my job? Which is maintaining, you know, working in the boiler, stoking the inadequacy or the fear. And I think very important to realize that there is a resistance to it because it doesn't make sense. And that as bodhisattvas, our vow is to be present in whatever realm we find ourselves. And so that's, you know, we're talking about being present in these realms of suffering. And I want to say equally, to be present in the realms of equanimity and ease and to not fall asleep, to not think, oh, well, now I get to take a break, you know, and then I'll start working again when the bad stuff comes. but to keep moving into deeper and deeper, wherever we are, just skimming the surface. So when when it does ease up, and for all of us, it does at times, to be present to that, to honor your bodhisattva vow. So in this realm of ease or the gods or the realm of clarity, not to stop, not to imagine, oh yeah, okay, check. No checks, but what is this? How can I dive totally into bliss and ease? So, Dominic, and then Karen, and then there. Yeah.
Melissa, you said that acting from that place causes harm to other people. Can you say more about that?
If we don't own the ocean, and it's very apparent that we are living from that place, but we keep coming from the small place, if we don't know that for ourselves, it's very confusing to people. And it can cause, what's the word for it? Dissonance, a disbelief in. I know I'm thinking of a teacher I used to work with in the long line of assholes in our staff. Just who would act from a certain place, and I would sense something else was happening, and if I named it, he would say, no, that's not true. You're making that up. And I believed him because, you know, he was my teacher, and seemed like...
I'm sorry.
I was trying to be so careful. It wasn't him. It could have been any of us. Just that, you know, any of us can be an asshole. So this is the danger. And I think, you know, I'm guilty of it myself when I'm in a self... somebody just did this to me the other day. I was feeling tired and sick, and it was after Doksan, and I was saying, oh, why did I even do this? This job is impossible. And my dear friend, one of you, said, well, you wanted this. You asked for it. Right, though. You know, but, like, it's this, Marianne Williamson says this, who are you to, I can't remember her exact quote, but who are you to be small? Mm-hmm. We're all capable of incredible insight. I've seen it, you know, it's one of the reasons I love to do Doksan, because I learn so much from the people who come in the room. There's so much wisdom, but it's often obscured by not believing that it could be so. Mm. So it's something, that's what I meant by that. It's not exactly, well, I hope that was as clear as it could be.
Carol, two more.
Kind of following up on what you're saying, I think it's very confusing to kind of walk in that divine pride, because a lot of times we relate to it as the ego relates to it, but it isn't that way. It's more spacious and more humble and more the divine pride of not knowing. That's kind of new territory. We have to actually be able to sit in that and walk as that.
Exactly.
Yeah. And to there's also so yes. Yes.
I know it's dangerous.
And to not also to be aware of how we can make even not knowing into a thing we know.
One more little thing too before we go to that next question. Yeah, and we're just floating around this saying apparently different things, but they're not really different. And you know that there's also the gift of admitting this stuff. Sometimes, you know, I wonder if it's useful. I think it's really useful to know we're all human. And then, you know, so Josh did that, and then gave a beautiful talk. Like, how can an inadequate person give a beautiful talk? This is part of what the work is. To really own it all. And I just really want to affirm that we don't have to get rid of anything, and we can show up as our beautiful, big self at the same time. But I think your point is something important, Karen. If it's a, and Josh just affirmed it too, if it's an idea, then we're lost. Where's Jeremy? Go ahead, Jeremy. Jeff, and then Jeremy.
This is kind of a thought and formation, I guess, but pulling together a couple of threads from Josh and one from you, Melissa. I appreciated what Josh said about not getting lost in our large stories, and also your description of Faye. And I love the sort of thought that over the arc of life, maybe we relate to our stories a little more loosely. As I told David yesterday, I entered Sashin midstream, and I came right before yesterday's Tesha, and I have to admit, bringing the pen of mine I brought to Sashin, which is still here with me, I kind of sat through the Tesha and our discussion thinking, who are these people? Just a bunch of psychopaths. And this this relative and absolute stuff. I mean, this is just, you know, this is just mind camp. This is and I started to listen to Bircher and just get lost in that for me. Imagine it was quite beautiful. I came back to this and the discussion thinking, this is kind of how humans sing. One of our large stories is a story about the relative and the absolute. And on the point of faith, you know, to me it's just, and maybe over the arc of a life, more a sense of this, and joy in the singing as well.
Jeremy, and then maybe just one more. We need to.
Well, I just want to say it's a pleasure to be here for your first stage show, Josh. And I love that you quoted Wendell Berry, big fan. And I spent a lot of time in the dark, both literally and metaphorically. And something I've learned from the literal experience is that if I calm down and wait long enough, I can see. But it's a different kind of scene. And it calls for a different way of moving. And sometimes, you know, it can be disorienting not to have my usual points of reference and to have to do it in a different or an unfamiliar way. And sometimes I still fuck it up and stub my toe or fall down. But I can do it. And the thing that I've noticed most of all that it calls for is for me to basically calm down, shut up, and wait, and sort of move. Gently and with some patience. And the other thing that I wanted to say is the thought
good clarification.
I really like connect to and the you know some of this talk about you know, the suffering and the darkness really resonates with me much of the time. And some, you know, in, like my own stories and all that, and sometimes I bore the shit out of myself with that stuff. And so it makes me want to ask, like, okay, what else? Now what?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah. And what a gift when we're, bored by our stories. Hallelujah. And I just want to respond also to that the beautiful expression that you gave of if you calm down and patiently be in the dark, that something changes. And there's a literal physical analog to this. Our eyes become dark adapted. Right, our eyeballs in the realm of the world, when we're in the dark, we start to be able to be in that dark. But if we're standing in the dark and we keep focusing our eyeballs on that one street lamp down the road because we can see that, then we prevent our eyes from becoming dark adapted.
Mm-hmm. Was there somebody else?
Really?
Yeah. There were
Yeah, it's a big story here, isn't it?
Oh, amen.
Yeah, a lot of confidence. Thank you.
So I would say calm down, stay still, and shut up.
There you go. Thanks, Brett.